tonight on Arena, we speak to the 2020 winner of the Rooney Prize for Literature, and two new movies, two new albums up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Rooney Prize has just announced its 2020 winner. The Rooney Prize, awarded annually for an outstanding body of work by an emerging Irish writer under 40 years of age. I'm delighted to divulge that this year's winner is Stephen Sexton, poet and author of If All the World and Love Were Young. You may remember, in fact, that we reviewed the collection last year. And one very notable aspect of the work, I think, was how Stephen brought his love of gaming and a depth of emotional expression together in the poems and in this collection. Delighted to be joined this evening by Stephen Sexton on the line. Congratulations, first of all, Stephen. A wonderful prize to win, an important one, the Rooney Prize.
Absolutely. You know, I am utterly overjoyed, and thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to chat. And I was going to mention it too, but yes, you've been so kind to talk about the book in the past, and I appreciate it so much. You know, it's really wonderful.
There might be a few reasons we were talking about the book, and we'll get to those. The quality of the work speaks for itself, Stephen, particularly in the winning of this prize. It puts you among an elite group of Irish writers. It really is. It's a real a marker, I suppose, for an emerging writer, which is a great thing and an encouraging thing. Is it a thing that puts pressure on you as well?
I don't know. It's largely, for me, it's largely been a joyous thing. And I mean, I wish I could say that I haven't over the years had a little peep at the other people who have won this prize. But, you know, it's an extraordinary list of people. So, I mean, Anne Enright is one of the winners, Kevin Barry, Sarah Baum, Durin Negrifa, Mark O'Connell last year, and, you know, some colleagues of mine like Glenn Patterson and Leontia Flynn and Nick Laird. So, I mean, among, you know, that's a handful over, I think, 44 years. Yeah. But utterly extraordinary company. And, yeah, it is thrilling. So no pressure yet, only remarkable happiness.
Well, why not? Why not enjoy the happiness while it's there? Sure. And even in that handful that you name, as you say, all of them now household names, really, in terms of literary endeavours. So let's talk about If All the World and Love Were Young. And I love the fact that to do so, we have to talk about Super Mario.
We do. So yeah, and you described it so kindly. I mean, I started, you know, in a kind of mischievous mood some years ago. I was thinking, you know, I was writing about lots of visual objects, you know, like paintings and photographs and that sort of thing. And I drew terribly bored of doing that. And in what I can only describe as a very mischievous mood, I thought, you know, well, why don't I turn it to something else? Why don't I turn this kind of grand tradition of writing about paintings? You know, Auden has poems about the old masters, and it's in that tradition. And I thought, well, you know, why not have a little fun? And I started writing about that, but it's you know, it turns out it's not that. You know, I started writing about Mario, and I'm sure many of us will know what Mario looks like, but, you know, a little video game character. He runs left to right across the screen and vibrant landscapes, and I started describing this as if it was a real landscape, and somehow along the line I realized, you know, I wasn't really just describing this video game. When it came to thinking about, you know, the garden I grew up in relative countryside in County Down, and thinking about the video game, I started thinking about growing up and about my mother, who died a couple of years before I started writing this. So entirely by surprise, this book that I thought was a little mischievous bit of fun turned into something very serious. It, you know, and whether or not it's my own subconscious, you know, tricking me into writing what I was avoiding writing about, I don't know. But that's what happened. I ended up with this book that's exactly half about Super Mario World and exactly half, this quite long elegy.
Yeah, and I suppose, why wouldn't you be writing about the death of your mother? But the mixing of that in with the Super Mario thing at one level seems quite odd. But if you think about it, I presume there were times in your youth when perhaps your mother was saying, would you get off that Super Mario, please, for 10 minutes and go and do something like read a few poems or read a book?
Or go outside or something.
Even,
like that.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, I don't do it so much anymore, but occasionally my dad would still say, you know, are you still at those games? And it's not so often. But yes, it was that, you know, it's this feeling of being engrossed in it. And one of the odd things, I suppose, is And maybe anyone who knows the game will know this feeling. But, you know, I know every inch of that game as if it was a real place. You know, and there's this feeling of, you know, this strange feeling of, you know, you see yourself on a screen, not as yourself. And trying to think of, you know, that very powerful experience of what grief does that kind of takes you outside of yourself in some ways. And you see yourself moving, but you don't quite feel like you're there. So it was this trying to make a way of, making grief feel like something.
I don't want to overstate it, but do you think to a certain extent something like Super Mario and other video games, in and of their very nature, the different levels that they bring us to, the essential quest that underlies many games, do you think that perhaps they're underestimated in terms of the mythological underlying that might be there, or certainly the storytelling that underlies them?
I think they can be. I mean, they occupy a kind of strange place in our culture to some extent, because they're not primarily thought of as narratives. So they're not quite films. I mean, some of them become filmic, but I think they are. And I mean, they can be incredibly sophisticated things. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of philosophy and philosophizing that goes into making these work. Mm. And for me, I mean, what I ended up doing is comparing Mario to Dante of the Divine Comedy, you know, two Italian men roaming around strange, fantastic landscapes, trying to stay out of trouble. So I definitely recognize a kind of mythological background to this. Whether or not it's exactly there, I think it's there for us to see it if we want to.
And I think there's something delicious for those who like figures and those who have mathematical brains as well as metric brains, which I suppose you need to a certain extent as a poet. You've mirrored the structure of the Super Mario game in the structure, the form of your poems.
Yes, I have. Well, I tried to come up with some way of doing that. I mean, it was so important to me that these poems, as much as they could, might feel like they had they'd come from a machine, as if they had been translated from a Nintendo into language. So I had my little system, I suppose. The Super Nintendo is a 16-bit processor. That's to say, it can process 16 bits of information at one time. So I made my lines all 16 syllables long, as a way of, you know, representing a kind of sweep of memory. You know, this is a book that's pretty much all about memory and how it processes and how it changes. And I wanted my line to try and act like a processor, that it was doing these big long sweeps across and trying to retain whatever was there.
Were you surprised? Was there a particular moment when it ceased being, you know, a little mischievous playing around with Super Mario and the 16-bit console, the 16-syllable line, into something that had a much deeper emotional current running through it, i.e. the death of your mother and the emotions around grief?
There were a couple of occasions, and you know, I can't point to exactly what they are sometimes, but there were a few occasions where I thought, this is becoming something I didn't quite realize it was. And I guess I had to make the choice to go on with it or not to. And I ultimately decided, this is what I have to do. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't mean to sound supernatural necessarily, but I it's true that I did feel an odd kind of presence around my shoulder when I was writing this. You know, there was something that was compelling me to do this. I wasn't sure what it was, but I thought it was something to be trusted.
Isn't there a missing picture, a missing photograph that's part of the story as well?
There is. So this book, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of people, and I looked it up online, and it turns out it is. But sometime when I was very young, my mother took a photograph of me sitting with my legs crossed playing Super Mario. And it turns out this is kind of a common image. I think there's a lot of, especially at Christmas, maybe with young people getting new games consoles, that kind of image. And you know, that's an image that I remember, and I remember seeing, but you know, I can't find this. And it's interesting to me, I suppose, because it's, you know, this book, I guess, represents her as the maker. You know, this is her picture that I am, you know, I am a subject of this in the way that my book makes her the subject, you know.
And indeed, you are now teaching in the Seamus Heaney Centre for Poetry at Queen's in Belfast. And I can only imagine what your students make of Super Mario being part of their course. And I hope that the next time your father asks you, you're still playing around with those games, you'll say, are those the ones that won me the Rooney Prize for Literature 2020, Dad? Yeah, I'm still playing around with them. Will you finish up with one of the poems from the collection for us, Stephen?
I'd be delighted to. Thank you. And yes, I mean, I just noticed when I was looking through these earlier that Yeah, we're in Sagittarius. Not that that matters to me, but this poem happens there. So that means right. that this poem happened, I don't know, about 11 years ago to these couple of days. Okay, Donut Secret 2. It is winter in the Ulster Hospital, and winter outdoors, and winter in our hemisphere. The tilt of the planet says so. Since she has lost her sense of taste, we have dinner in McDonald's. If I'm going to die, she says, might as well go to McDonald's. The kitchen bleeps and chirps and blips, the cryptolect of ICUs, whose automatic song desires no singer's articulation. Her hair is thin under the light, and surgery will be discussed tonight, while fleets of gritters salt all the main arterial routes. The country roads we travel home by purple and glisten with frost, under the constellations and the Sagittarian moon.
Stephen Sexton there with his poem Donut Secret 2, part of his collection If All the World and Love Were Young. Stephen, congratulations once again on the collection and on the winning of the Rooney Prize this evening.
Thank you. A joy.
Stephen Sexton, his book is published by Penguin. Now, perhaps it's talking to Stephen Sexton, the winner of the 2020 Rooney Prize, that has me in a particular poetic mood this evening and plunging into the practice of alliteration in our films. We have two letter P's to start you out with. Patrick is the story of a missing hammer at a Belgian nudist camp. And in Possessor, Andrea Riseborough plays a body-swapping assassin, and she is directed by, and the script as well is written by, Brandon Cronenberg. And yes, he is one of those Cronenbergs. And with me in studio here is Justin McGregor, Ruth Barton joining us on the line. They have watched both films. And let's start with the sci-fi film. Is that what we're talking about, Ruth Barton, in case of Possessor? Is it sci-fi?
Well, yes, it is, in the kind of looser sense of the terms. So when you think of sci-fi, you think of something set in the future. This is, in fact, set in the past, reimagined as if it might have been the future. Well, to complicate things even further, it actually bears strong resemblance to a horror movie. But I think all the same, you could call it sci-fi because it is about a world imagined that is entirely dystopian, which is basically what sci-fi does.
Yeah, and a kind of dystopian in 2008 in a peculiar type of way, mixing that past and future thing. Justin McGregor, as Ruth was saying there. So Andrea Riseborough is our assassin here, but things are going a little bit wrong for her, Justin.
Yes, well, it's a slightly unusual assassination system. They implant chips into people's heads, and then the assassin controls that body, and they use them as the weapon of their assassination. Apparently, eventually, it starts to decay, this system, and she's hiding the fact that it's not going so well for her. And on her most recent assignment, that is the focus of the film, where she takes over Colin Tate's body, she's beginning to lose control of the host.
Yeah, and Colin Tate is played by Christopher Abbott here. So he's going to be doing the assassinating for her. And who is he attempting to assassinate?
He's going to assassinate his future father-in-law, played by Sean Bean, and his fiance, who's Sean Bean, John Parse's daughter, Ava Parse. So he's going to kill all of them and then himself so that the brother can inherit the company.
Wow.
It's all paid for.
Where there's a will, there's a relative. Isn't that what they say? Okay, let's listen to a clip now. Andrea Riseborough, Tasia Voss, is that how we say her name?
Tasia Voss.
She works for this company, and Gerda, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, is the kind of the CEO, or she's the chief buck cat of this particular assassinating corporation. And here she is explaining to Tasia what her next assignment will entail.
Consider the face of Colin Tate. Father deceased, mother estranged, no siblings. Deals cocaine for a few years, then falls in love and becomes engaged to one of his rich clients, Ava Parse. She's the daughter of John Parse, CEO of Zuthru.
Zuthru?
Data mining. Largest operation outside the U.S. Head office is local. But our deal is with Reed Parse, John's stepson.
And what's the narrative?
Well, imagine Colin Tate as the unstable lover who feels diminished by his new family. Ava has all the power in the relationship. It's emasculating. He starts using more behavior, becoming more and more erratic. Ultimately, he breaks, killing John, kills Ava, kills himself. With Ava out of the picture, Reed inherits everything. Becomes CEO, cry for the cameras, clean tragedy, no one answered questions. Pay is significant. Money and shares. But the real target, according to corporate, is Uthru itself. Because once we own Reed, we own the company. Right? So when do I stop?
Andrea Riseborough and Jennifer Jason Leigh in a scene there from Possessor. Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor are reviewers on this Thursday evening. And Ruth, Brandon Cronenberg, at one level, when I listen to that clip, it sounds like a fairly straightforward, almost heist film or you know, a thriller where you have somebody's chasing the money, they're trying to take over the corporation, that class of straightforward genre film. But if there's a Cronenberg involved, I'm presuming the luck must go skew-ways at some time, or else he's not his father's son, his father being David Cronenberg.
His father being David Cronenberg, and, you know, just to prompt everybody's mind, that is The Fly, Scanners, and a series of classic horror movies. And this will be a classic film too, and he very, very clearly has learnt from his father. He's made his own way too. It's a much more modern movie. Obviously, he's really engaging with the corporate world, which wasn't his father's territory so much, because this is film, as that clip showed us, is all about, you know, corporate espionage and malfeasance. And then of course what we have, and this is the part, you know, this is the part where the movie and I parted ways fairly early on. And in fact, I mean, really, to review it, I'm now about to inhabit the body of a sci-fi horror fan, because it starts off with violent, violent visceral bloodshed, and then it also culminates in this incredibly extended stabbing scene. So it's horror and it's sci-fi all blended into one. You have to be a fan to love this kind of thing.
It sounds, though, as if the apple doesn't fall far from the tree then, Justin, in that case. In fact, you've made, you see this almost is it too much to say a sequel? Certainly a companion piece to one of to Brandon Cronenberg's father's, one of his films.
No, David Cronenberg made a movie called Videodrome in 1983, which was about a television station that showed kind of violent, torturous content, but really it was giving brain tumors to its viewers, so that people who liked that kind of thing would die off. And at one point, James Woods, the owner of this TV station, this other TV station, ends up with a VHS in his stomach that controls his mind. And so it felt very much like a sequel to Videodrome. And that film used Rick Baker and manual effects, which this film does too. There's no CGI in the film. And it just really felt like it was going over that same territory, but updated.
But you spotted within it, Ruth, and I don't know if you're still in the body of the sci-fi fan for this part of the review.
Regrettably, I'm stuck and struggling to get out.
You're stuck in there. You'll need Jennifer Jason Leigh to give you a hand to get out. Police violence is in there and gender issues are addressed. How does that come across in something that seems to veer away from that kind of almost social realism or that type of commentary?
Yeah, the opening sequence features the attack on a black woman. So Andrea Riseborough's character, Tasia Voss, has to take over this black woman force her to do her will. But then at the end, Tasia Voss is supposed to commit suicide in order to exit the body. But this is one of her problems. You know, she has this weakness. She can't. So she instead presents herself, if you like. She starts shooting at the cops, who then shoot her really randomly without any good reason. So I think, you know, we can see that as that's a direct kind of Black Lives Matter, corrupt police force kind of commentary. So, you know, that seems to be to bring it, you know, back into, I mean, I think Videodrome was at the 80s, Justin. You know, it brings it into 2020 with those kind of references. And there's also, you know, you have to remember that Tasia Voss is transporting herself into a man's body. And so there is, I think, something quite nice going on about, you know, our bodies not being gendered, or, you know, about body transformation. And it's not unproblematic, because at one point when she, as Colin, is having sex, then she suddenly returns to being herself. So those are nice kind of twists on yeah. you know, contemporary issues.
But for all of that, I mean, we've talked about this very strong, like, almost plot espionage story that's in there. But I think you've felt, David Cronenberg sitting in front of me, Justin McGregor sitting in front of me, you felt that, in fact, the visual style was more important than the storytelling, really? Or am I putting words in your mouth?
No. They spend a lot of effort getting these kind of effects, like as Ruth is mentioning, when the bodies transform, it goes to this kind of red light sort of effect that was all done in camera. But somehow it just leaves you hollow and empty. Like you don't really know who's running the Colin Tate body at some times. You don't really know what the stakes are. And I had to fill out a form for the HSE, and I was thinking about that form while I was watching the second half of the movie, which is not a good sign.
No, not a good sign. So did it work overall for you, Ruth? I think you have a feeling that it could become a cult classic. Becoming a cult movie doesn't always mean it's a great movie, does it?
Yeah, it's not the biggest praise for a movie. I think it has a small niche audience that will love this film and will admire it. You know, its ideas and its technique. I think for the wider world, it's going to be skip it, miss it. And, you know, take my advice. If you do get squeamish, this is not the movie for you. So, I mean, in terms of stars, I'm giving it 3.5.
3.5 from Ruth. What are you saying overall, Justin?
Oh, no, way too much blood for me and just bored. I gave it 2.
2. All right. Well, a slight difference of opinion, but I don't think either of you rushing back at any moment to see Possessor from Brandon Cronenberg. Let's move on then to film number 2, the Belgian nudist camp in the 1980s for Tim Malan's feature debut, Patrick. I suppose, Ruth, listeners may be familiar with Tim Malan's work on Peaky Blinders, but we're not in that world.
We are so far.
Now, I have to be allowed at least one. So could you lay out the bare facts of this movie for me, please?
Well, yeah, I'm not slipping into the bodies of any of these of any of the characters in this. It's set, as you said, in the Belgian nudist camp, actually in the 1980s. So that's one other thing they have in common, apart from their first letter P. They're the likenesses, surely stop. So Patrick is the central character. He's played by Kevin Janssens. He has mild learning difficulties, and it's his parents' camp. It starts off with this. I mean, I just love this sequence. It starts off fairly early on with a meeting of the members of the camp, and they're sitting around what would be like sort of, you know, corporate meeting room table, but of course they're all naked. There's a sort of odd, tastefully draped scarf or cardigan over somebody's shoulders. So they meet, and they're critical of his father. And then it's not giving anything away to say that his father dies quite early on. And after this, Patrick goes off in search of his missing hammer. And as one of the characters kindly points out to him, he's really mourning the loss of his father, but he's projecting it onto the lost hammer.
Let's point out that he does have a collection of hammers, all of them,
yes,
you know,
indeed.
Slightly gradated in size, maybe an inch bigger as they go up. He has about 5 or 6 of them, and he has them perfectly little place for them sculpted in his workshop. He makes beautiful furniture. So that's one level of it. Justin, but as Ruth pointed out there, these clothes are not strategic. These jumpers over shoulders are not strategically placed. This is total nudity. But after, I don't know how quick it was for you, but at a certain point, it's just people who happen to have no clothes on who are acting as characters.
Yeah.
The nudity, does it become irrelevant, or what function does it serve?
It's amazing, the fearlessness of the actors. Yeah, with the women maybe just having pearls on. And yeah, these cardigans wrapped around the neck. Like,
well,
for
it was
the
getting
tennis
a bit cold,
club.
Wasn't it?
It was getting a bit cold. But you just kind of let go. You just go into their world. It actually helps you really kind of get drawn in, and it all becomes really serious. You start to see everything from their point of view and this amazing camp, and it becomes irrelevant, you know, but the genius of the actors and the director to give those performances, these incredibly realistic and nuanced performances, while, you know, completely vulnerable, you know, in their nudity as well. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a scene, because there is a little bit of it in a couple of scenes in English within the midst of it all. One of the wonderfully named Dustin Apollo, who's kind of a singer, as you'll hear, Jamine Clement playing the character here, and Kevin Janssens playing the character of Patrick. And this is the pop star arriving at reception to announce himself.
What is your name?
My name? You don't know my name? You don't know my name. You don't recognize me.
Ooh, baby, you knew when we started.
You were gonna end up brokenhearted, baby, you knew that. And you came along anyway.
I'm Dustin Apollo.
Hey, can you write it down?
That's cool, you don't know my name. That's really cool.
Bathroom is here, always bring towel with
heard,
you.
You never heard. Don't you worry, baby, we're gonna be fine. We don't need to rush it, we just take our time.
So bathroom
that's
is
cool, here. Man, that's cool.
River starts here, tree line starts here.
What's your name?
Patrick.
I like you, Patrick.
So, bathroom is here, always bring towel with you. River starts here, and the tree line starts here.
Hey, has Natalie arrived yet?
Natalie?
Yeah, very beautiful, incredible eyes. She's got blonde hair, she smells like honey.
No.
Kevin Jansen's there as Patrick and Jamin Clements as Dustin Apollo, the pop star. Do you think all of his songs are as brilliant as the two we heard there? Just I don't know if it comes across, but it's absolutely hilarious when you're watching it. That scene, we were roaring laughing listening to it here, but there is a kind of absurdity about the whole thing. Him on one side, the other guy on the other side, buck naked.
No, and it's a real theme of the film, that there are these incredibly absurd moments treated with real earnestness and real seriousness, and it really works. I mean, there's a local policeman who tries to guide Patrick on how to find his hammer, and it's like he's trying to help him find, you know, the Book of the Ancients or the Ark of the Covenant. It's like, but do not get emotional. Like, it's absolutely brilliant. Like, the and you, as I say, it just draws you in this sort of wonderful way, and so funny. The dryness of it and the absurd situations, just absolutely hilarious.
Bruce, did you find yourself really caring about Patrick, the Kevin Jansen's character, and his mother as well, who's blind? The character is blind, played by Kathleen Gemin, I think is her name.
Yes, absolutely. And here's an interesting thing. She wears clothes. So why does she wear clothes? Because she's blind. You know, I mean, this is the kind of absurd, you know, place this movie is taking us into. I thought Kevin Janssen's was fantastic. Because Patrick is, you know, he is really almost emotionless. He's stumbling through this movie, and as you heard in this exchange, he doesn't really get people very well. He really only gets his hammer. And yet you can see how vulnerable he is, and he's vulnerable because he's emotionally vulnerable, whereas everybody else in the camp is vulnerable because they don't have any clothes on. And it does, you know, as Justin says, it pulls you in, and you're kind of following him, and you want everything to be all right for him. You want him to find this hammer. and then, of course, he does, you know, the girlfriend that Dustin Apollo is looking for, Natalie, turns out to be an absolute angel, and not in a kind of sickly sense, but she gets him, and so she's kind of our connection to him as well, because she understands him, and she kind of comforts him, and she connects him a little bit to the real world at the end of the film.
It did kind of go a bit into a peculiar world, though, at the end of it. Maybe the final act of the film felt like a different film in some ways. It became about something else, and we left the camp, which I thought was a real shame. It's not that I was, you know, wanted more nudity, but the camp was a great place.
The camp was a great place, and it's true. Yeah, he's taken off to Brussels for about 15 minutes, and I agree, there's a real lag there where, I mean, he is a very passive character, but a kind of lovely passive character, and then he starts to fall into this situation, I don't want to give too much away, that is really very frustrating, because you see that there's many ways out of it for him.
Yeah.
And eventually there's sort of a bit of a deus ex machina where he gets rescued and pulled out of it, and then can finally have his final kind of growth, as it were, at the end. But yeah, had a little slip at the end, I thought,
how does that all translate into stars for you, first of all, Justin?
Oh, I thought it was funny, it was moving, it was impactful. I thought it was mostly brilliant, so an easy 4.5.
An easy 4.5. I was totally enamoured of this as well, I have to say, apart from that last 15 minutes or so, which I did think kind of lost it for me. What about you, Ruth?
Oh yeah, I didn't see this movie coming at all. I just thought it was so unexpected. Mm. I've never seen another movie set in a 1980s Belgian nudist camp.
It's a whole new genre we're going to have to go searching
it
now.
It is, and I'm quite excited about it. So, but yeah, I mean, 4 out of 5, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
All right, 4 out of 5, and I'd be with both of you up on the high marks for that one. Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor speaking to us there latterly about Patrick, the Tim Meilands film, and before that, about Possessor. Now, on tomorrow night, Irina, we have a special programme for you, in fact, which we recorded a while back now at Molly, the Museum of Literature Ireland, as part of the Dublin Book Festival. Roddy Doyle will be with us talking about his novel Love, Christine Dwyer Hickey, whose breakthrough novel Tatty is the One City, One Book novel for this year. She'll be there as well, or was there with us, as was Kevin Barry, speaking about his new collection of short stories, That Old Country Music. And we have music as well from Yuli Murphy. So that special programme, as in the usual slot, 7 to 8 tomorrow night here on Arena. But that means that on Thursday evening we have our album reviews this week, and album number 11 from Smashing Pumpkins, hugely successful Chicago rock band led by Billy Corgan, the darlings of MTV and the alternative rock scene of the 1990s. This is a 20 song 72 minute offering entitled Seer, and How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow is the 8th album from Norwegian born singer and songwriter Anna Brun, the second she's given us in the last 2 months, hugely popular in Scandinavia but a loyal fan base here in Ireland as well. Lauren Murphy and Eamon Sweeney have been listening. We'll start with Smashing Pumpkins and the album Seer, being described by NME magazine as, quote, their poppiest record to date. Do you agree? This is the title track. Where you from creation's crown. And that was Smashing Pumpkins. Yes, Smashing Pumpkins, and the title track from their current album, Seer. Last album was produced by music legend Rick Rubin. This one produced by the band's leader, Billy Corgan. Eamon Sweeney and Lauren Murphy, as I said, have been listening and they're with me now. Their poppiest sound ever from this band, Eamon, would you concur?
Oh, absolutely not. I think NME are listening to a different album here. If your definition of poppy is a very beige version of New Order, then maybe. And admittedly, like, first time I listened to this record, I absolutely hated it. It has grown upon me slightly. And The Colour of Your Love, I see what they're going for, but I do not get the logic of, when you have a band of Jimmy Chamberlain, James Iha, these great musicians, that they're kind of relegated to the kind of plodding rhythm section in the background. And there's a lot, there's maybe just a bit too much Billy Corgan in the monitors. He's written everything. He's produced everything. I think his vocal over 20 songs or 72 minutes, as you're saying there, really grates after a while.
Yeah, 20 songs, 72 minutes, Lauren Murphy. It's a double album is what he or they are calling it, depending on who's actually in charge here, I guess. The double album, it's never an easy feat, is it?
Yeah, and especially with a band like Smashing Pumpkins, whose probably best album is a double album back from the 90s, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, which is an album that still stands up. It's such a great album. And I think that album worked brilliantly because it had a really strong concept and some brilliant songs like Bullet with Butterfly Wings and Tonight Tonight. But this album just doesn't have the same kind of ambition or vision or whatever you want to call it. It just really doesn't work. It didn't work for me. It just seemed kind of all over the place. And like Eamon said, a bit like the Billy Corgan show, with none of the other musicians really getting a look in.
Interestingly, Eamon, you said that the first time you listened to this, you thought, no, but you had to persevere with it. Now, part of the reason, thank you for persevering with it, was that you were coming in to review it. So you have to persevere with an album. You can't just say, I don't like it and turn it off. But take your reviewer's hat off for a moment. If this wasn't Smashing Pumpkins, would you have listened to a track or two and said, that's it, good night, I'm gone, I'm not listening to any more of this drivel?
Yeah, very good question. It is a testing album. I think even for ardent Pumpkin fans, this would be a testing album. Because it bears no relation to, Lauren was there mentioning about it. It's 25 years since that record. This is nothing. And in terms of Lauren saying there about a strong concept, Billy Corgan has been whittering on about kind of a spiritual dystopia, but without really clarifying what he means as being the concept of this album.
Yeah.
Maybe the spiritual dystopia is just being in an endless loop of with this record, because he's claiming he's got another 40 songs ready to go.
Yeah,
so the guy obviously has...
In fact, dystopic folly, I think, is another phrase that he's used around the album, Lauren.
Yeah, he's come out with all these sorts of really pretentious descriptions, dystopic folly, one soul against the world sort of stuff, set against a backdrop of shifting loyalties and sped up time. I mean, how pretentious can you get? The music actually matches it. I mean, the music, it just seems really overblown. It's not until 9 songs in that we really get a glimpse of the old Smashing Pumpkins with a song called Witch. And that you really welcome that because you get a proper sense of the band, of the drums and the guitar, and an edginess that is missing from so much of this album.
Well, let's have a listen to a track called, you talked about pretentiousness. Is Dulcet in E a pretentious title or not?
Yes.
I don't know about the rest of you, but as I'm listening to that, my inner boy band choreographer is very busy and I can see myself choreographing 3 or 4 fine looking young fellas into a fine bit of dancing and hands up in the air and a few twirlies and it'd be grand. Is this the Smashing Pumpkins at all, Lauren? Is it just, should we forget about it and go back to earlier work and leave it at that?
Well, I know that's what I'm going to be doing because I really did not like this album. I mean, songs like that. There's another song called Rat that fares close to like yacht rock of the 80s. Like, to give them credit, Corgan said they're taking a risk with this album. That's certainly true and it's admirable to an extent. I mean, there's certainly no old rehashing of, you know, past glories, and there's a lot to be said for trying something new. But the problem is that none of it just sounds very convincing.
Oh, dear. And I did read several critics talking about it bears repeated listening. I'm always worried when you have to say that. You need something to make you want to listen on the first listen, Eamon.
And again, we're coming back to this hurdle of it being a double album.
Yeah.
The cliche goes that maybe in a bad double album, there is one great single album trying to get out. I would struggle to put the good tracks on this on an EP, let alone a single album.
Maybe the good tracks are in the other 40 that he's... Oh, 40 that you said that he has ready to go?
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Well, see, this is it. This guy now, he's a wrestling promoter. He's involved with Chicago Cubs, lots of kind of sports teams in the States. He's friends with Dennis Rodman. I think he inhabits a very strange world. Right. I think he's really doing this. And also kind of like the thread of recent interviews is, I don't care if you don't like this. I really do not care.
Oh, I bet he's really upset listening to you two this evening. Billy, so sorry. Stars from you, first of all, Eamon?
2.
2 from Eamon Sweeney for Smashing Pumpkins and Seer. What are you saying, Lauren Murphy?
Yeah, I'll go with 2 as well. Even if it was condensed into 12 tracks, it'd still be very poor. So 2 out of 5.
Not happy cookies with us this evening on poor old Billy Corgan. Let us move on then to Anna Bruin. We actually spoke about her album a couple of weeks back. Well, it's a couple of months back now, isn't it? After the Great Storm, which was in all in and around her father's. Did you review that for us, Eamon?
No, I thought, for some reason,
you suddenly came into my head. Were you sitting opposite me that evening too? No. And it was very, very positively reviewed, I remember, and a very emotional album it was as well. This is, if you like, it could be, you could consider After the Great Storm and this current album, Lauren, How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow. If not a double album, they're certainly companion pieces.
Yeah, in fact, it was actually originally conceived as a double album. I think she wrote the songs around the same time as the After a Great Storm. She'd camped at a cabin in the mountains and basically wrote near almost all of the songs from both of those albums. But it's very, if After a Great Storm was very much more of a band sort of effort, whereas this one is very much stripped down and mostly a solo album and more, I think, definitely more tender and vulnerable maybe than the last one. So it is different as much as it has related themes.
Yeah, and she had the good manners not to invite you to her home and make you eat 2 main courses, but to say, look, come this week for 1 main course and in a few weeks' time you can come and have another main course. Let's have a listen to a track called Closer. There we go, a song called Closer, second track, in fact, on Anna Bruin's second album of the last couple of months, How Beauty Holds the Hands of Sorrow. And Lauren Murphy, I was saying that it pretty much is a companion piece to After the Great Storm, which really deals with the death of her father. But as you listen to that, when you think she kind of almost got out some of the anger in the previous album, it struck me, the anger of grief. She's at a very different stage of her grief in this album. And I found that particular track, I thought the emotional content of it was really heart-wrenching.
Absolutely. This one, as you said, is very much about acceptance and vulnerability stage of grief, but certainly acceptance. And that song in particular is almost like a centerpiece of the album, because you can hear what she's singing about when you're in your darkest hour, you think you'll never recover. This is how you grow closer. Really, really lays her heart on the line this time. Very much kind of writing from the heart, and very much kind of, you know, acceptance is apparent from the very first lyric on the album to the last, really.
And what a voice she has to express the range of emotions that she goes through over just 9 songs, mannerly again, not overstaying her welcome. And I think it's 38, 39 minutes, somewhere in that region, Eamon. But a huge vocal range and a huge versatility within her vocals.
Absolutely. That works so well, because I think there's this very pleasing Scandinavian minimalism on this record. There's a little bit of orchestration, but generally it's just piano and her voice. And it lets that voice shine and come with these very, like, that song, a great example, as Darren says, kind of like a centerpiece, but like Last Breath, Lose My Way, that she's done with Dustin O'Halloran from Wing Victory from Sullen. The way that she kind of broaches death is fascinating. Yeah. And even this variations of the theme of if it doesn't kill you, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And she said lately, she thinks better. At least it can widen your perspectives, which I think is a wonderful way of going about it.
Yeah, as you said, the acceptance that even just looking at the song titles, Lose My Way, Don't Run and Hide, Breaking the Surface, Gentle Wind of Gratitude, Trust, Meet You at the Delta, and the one that I want to play now, Song for Thrill and Tom. Does any the specifics of are Thrill and Tom? Is this a reference to the father, or are these characters? Does anybody know that?
I don't know.
Lauren, you're not too sure.
Yeah. But it's just, I don't know who Thrill and Tom are, but they are very lucky to have a song like this written about them.
It's funny how things go. She said, I blind you, and you lead my way instead. He met her in the morning sun.
Decided I'd let the whole thing play. Anya Brune there with Song for Thrill and Tom, and that from her album How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow. This is sending me off to Spotify tonight and do a big Anya Brune search and listen to a back catalogue. Did it work for you overall, Eamon? Will it send you doing the same type of thing?
Oh, very much so. And I went back to after the Great Storm, and I think it's a much more interesting record.
This one is.
Yeah. Oh, I really think so. A much more powerful record. It really, the kind of emotional.
But you kind of needed, she needed the release of After the Great Storm to get to this point, presumably.
Absolutely. That's what makes this journey and these kind of companion albums so fascinating. In stark contrast, let's say no more about Smashing Pumpkins. Like, you know, when you have two good albums in the can, like Radiohead did way back in the noughties with Kid A and Amnesiac, rather than do this bloated double album thing to do it this way.
Is Anya Brune getting for stars for this album, How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow?
4 stars.
4 from Eamon Sweeney. Lauren Murphy, what are you saying?
Yeah, I really loved it as well. And I'm going to investigate her back catalogue as well, because she's clearly such a great songwriter. So 4 out of 5 for me
as
well.
Yeah, I think this is her 8th album, isn't it? And 2 of them in the last couple of months. And her father's death kind of put a halt on things for a while. So clearly she's back, and back with a bang for sure. How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow by Anya Brune, and Seer by Smashing Pumpkins, the 2 albums that Lauren Murphy and Eamon Sweeney spoke to us about this evening. I think I know which one they would like you to listen to more than the others. But that is our lot for this evening and for this week. No, it's not. I thought it was Friday night because of the album. But let me tell you before I sign off and tell you about tomorrow night that Leah Murphy was the researcher. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. And yes, we will be here this evening, but with a special pre-recorded programme. Roddy Doyle, Christine Dwyer Hickey and Kevin Barry. Musician Uli Murphy will be there as well. A special programme recorded at Molly, the Museum of Literature Ireland, and very interesting. I hope you will find it too. All part of Dublin Book Festival.